Welcome to Off Trail Learning. This is Blake Bowles. What motivates a teacher to quit teaching? Today I speak with Joel Hammond, who taught for over a decade in both public and private schools and was on track to earning a six-figure salary with full benefits. When he left, he stopped. He couldn't take it anymore. I interviewed Joel about what motivated his decision, about what he loved about teaching, about what really frustrated him. Joel is one of the co-founders of the Learning Cooperatives, a series of centers based on the North Star model in the New Jersey and Pennsylvania area. And I will actually be speaking at one of the Learning Cooperatives this fall on my fall speaking road tour. And I've got some new dates up on my homepage, blakebowles.com, which I've also redesigned a bit. So please go check them out there. And if you are in the Midwest or the Northeast or the Southeast, I might be speaking near you this fall. Without further ado, I bring you Joel. My guest today is Joel Hammond, the co-founder of Princeton Learning Cooperative and the author of The Teacher Liberation Handbook. And the subtitle of that book is How to Leave School and Create a Place Where You and Young People Can Thrive. Welcome, Joel.
Thanks, Blake.
So we've talked a lot on this podcast about young people thriving in school. Why do you write a book about where teachers can thrive? Isn't teaching a job? Is thriving really part of the job description? Shouldn't you just do your job as a teacher?
Well, I think everyone should try to thrive at their job.
Okay. Granted. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's, to be honest, I mean, there's a lot of talk about sort of young people in school and, you know, it might not be going well for them. Like I say in the book, you just start asking around to teachers and you'll find that there's a large number of them that are also, you know, unhappy with sort of the situation they find themselves in schools. And so, you know, that was part of the reason for writing the book, like just getting it out there so that people know that there's another option, just like, you know, young people know that there's another option besides school.
Mm-hmm. And are there other books about alternatives for teachers? Is there anything that you read before you decided you needed to write this book?
No, not that I know of. There probably are. I didn't do much research.
Okay. And you're the co-founder of Princeton Learning Cooperative in Princeton, New Jersey, but you are also the co-founder of a small empire of learning cooperatives in that area. Can you please elucidate?
Sure. A very small empire. So we started the Princeton Learning Cooperative back in 2010. And then we just realized that, you know, that there's opportunity for this in lots of different places. And so that we started a second center called the Bucks Learning Cooperative in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And then this past fall, we started one called the Raritan Learning Cooperative in Flemington, New Jersey.
Okay, so anyone in the greater New Jersey, Pennsylvania bordering areas, there are learning cooperatives waiting for you there.
Indeed.
More by the week, it seems. Cool. We're going to talk about being a teacher and the frustrations that can come with that and other paths that you can take if you like teaching but don't find that you fit into the system. So, Joel, start by telling us, what is your teaching background? What's your professional background?
Yeah, sure. I was, went to college for secondary education and social studies. So I was a history and, you know, kind of all-purpose social studies teacher for 11 years. Most recently in just a big suburban, you know, public school outside of Philadelphia. And, you know, like I mentioned in the book, you know, I come from a big family of teachers. Like, my dad is a teacher. My wife is still a teacher. You know, in the school actually I used to teach at. So, you know, I've been in that world pretty much my whole life.
How old are you now, Joel?
I'm 40.
All right. And what year did you quit teaching?
It was 2011, I believe.
Okay. In the book, you wrote that if you could only reach one or two students, and you were talking about a current issues class that you were teaching to seniors, mm-hmm. and you had 20 students. That sounds pretty nice, only 20 students in a class.
Yeah.
But you said that only maybe one or two of those students would actually show up if the whole thing was voluntary and they weren't doing it for credit, for any other sort of extrinsic reward.
Yeah.
So what's the problem with that? Why, if you can reach just one or two students, isn't it worth it, Joel?
I mean, sure, it is. I mean, the, you know, for my purposes, what I was interested in doing, you know, of course, whenever you can reach anyone, that's great. But I felt like that was like, you know, like a 5 or 10% success rate was just too low of a, yeah, that's not what I was.
In what field would a 5% success rate be acceptable?
Yeah, not even in baseball, right? You know, like 30%, you know, batting average is good. But I just didn't, you know, and I think that's one of those things, you know, sort of in the mythology of teaching, right? It's like, if I can just reach one kid, you know, it makes it all worth it. And, you know, the way I looked at it was just there were so many young people I worked with, you know, so if I had 120 kids in my classes each year, you know, I was reaching 10 of them. Like, I don't know. It just didn't feel like the way that I wanted to spend my time, and certainly not the, you know, why I went into teaching in the first place. And so, you know, I just, you know, that was sort of what got me started looking for like other alternatives. Like, are there other ways, you know, to work with young people where, you know, the impact that you're going to have for the kids that you're working with is just much larger. It's kind of how I got to where I am today.
And you share some really illuminating stories in the book, and I think the one that you lead with was the most powerful for me. You're describing an academically underperforming 13-year-old boy who comes into this room, and there's you, and there's other teachers, and there's the counselor, and some other administrators, and their parents are there, and mm-hmm. they're all just like surrounding this kid. And you wrote that you could see the indifference or the shame or the defiance rising depending on the student.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you really didn't like these meetings, but you were there anyways. Like, how much of this kind of stuff happened for you as a teacher? Was that a rare occurrence, or were these kinds of meetings where you felt bad afterwards for doing what you did more common?
Well, these were routine meetings. We'd have a couple of them a year, I would imagine. And the way that the middle school that I taught in was set up, you know, we had teams, right? So there was a social studies, science, math, and English teacher all on the same team, and we would share the same group of 120 kids or whatever it was. And that was the idea of the team concept, is that we, you know, there's four adults paying attention. If a kid was not doing well across the whole range, then, you know, we could have interventions. And so we would have these kind of meetings fairly regularly. The other thing I'll point out about this is, that those meetings, I probably was the only one thinking that in that meeting, right? Because I think a lot of times that desire, the meeting was set up, as a desire to help young people. Right? Like this, you know, it's not going well for this. What can we do? We need to get everyone on the same page. My own just personal take on it was just that this was not, you know, particularly helpful. I never saw it really improve, you know, the situation for these kids. Because going back to sort of the school mentality, and again, this is not to bash, you know, public schools, but, you know, if it's not going well for a kid, you know, the first place to look for the problem is always with the kid, right? It's not like the way that we have things set up is the problem. And so, mm-hmm. you know, those meetings were an attempt to figure out what's wrong with this kid. And, you know, I'm just sitting there thinking, well, maybe, you know, it's everything else, you know, and so, you know, what were we putting this family through? What were we putting this kid through when, you know, they probably would thrive under other circumstances? That it was just one of those things that stood out from my time teaching, where it just became clear to me that, I needed to do something else.
And you were teaching in one fashion or another for a decade. So what was the trajectory of your thought? When did you start having these thoughts of maybe it's not the kid, it's the system? Did you go in thinking these thoughts from the very beginning?
No, I went in very, you know, like I say in the book, very, idealistic, and, you know, believed in the power of traditional schools to really, you know, change the world, you know, change young people's lives and change the world. There had been, sort of inklings of things, previous to that. Like, I had, when I was in college, I had gotten into some kind of leftist sort of politics and started reading some like youth liberation sort of things. And that's how I came across Grace's book, Teenage Liberation Handbook, back right when I had graduated from college, so I hadn't even started teaching yet. And I kind of read it, and it was just sort of interesting, but I didn't, you know, obviously act on it. I still, you know, went into teaching. And it was really, you know, after those first couple of years where, you know, from a teaching standpoint, it was, you know, ideal. You know, I was teaching an all-girls private Catholic school outside of Philadelphia. There was zero discipline problems. You know, they just let me teach whatever I wanted. There's no curriculum. They're just like, you should do something on U.S. history and government. So we threw out all the textbooks. I mean, it was you know, from a teaching perspective, it was really wonderful.
That sounds like teacher liberation right there.
Yeah. But even with all that, you know, it was, you know, the first couple of years, you know, it's an exciting thing. You're working for the first time, making money for the first time, and, you know, you're, you know, just full of energy. But, you know, it became apparent, like, even with all the restrictions, typical restrictions on teachers taken away, you know, kids still looked at it as just something they had to do, right? It wasn't, again, it, you know, I was trying to do all the innovative things I could think of. And, you know, if the kids weren't required to be in that class, how many would have shown up? Not many, right? And so it really started getting me to sort of question what I was doing, you know? And so the evolution of my thinking around school really started there. And then, you know, when I moved over to the public schools, you know, just sort of accelerated. I found out about North Star, which I'm sure we'll mention as we go along. It would have been like 2007. You know, and I had left teaching by 2011. I had really not known anything about, you know, unschooling or self-directed education, growing up or in my teaching career. You know, it was all very traditional. And so it really was like a revelation to me, like, oh my God, you can do this. And, you know, that's just sort of what I was drawn to.
Mm-hmm. And we will talk about North Star and Liberated Learners, a lot in this episode. Mm-hmm. I want to focus for a moment on that moment where you started doubting the system and what conversations you were having with other people, what conversations you were having with yourself. And something that you bring up in the book is that you imagined yourself to be something like, you know, possibly like Robin Williams in the Dead Poets Society. And right. I know that's an inspirational movie, or Stand and Deliver with Jaime Escalante. You know, there's mm-hmm. all these yeah. classic tales that of powerful teachers that with responsive students, even if they don't really respond in the beginning, everyone gets onto the same team, mm-hmm. and these kids have these huge breakthroughs.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like you were set up to have an experience like that, as good as any teacher can be set up. And yeah. and so why didn't it happen? I'm not saying why didn't you know, become Robin Williams, but what was missing in the equation?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there definitely were kids that got it, right? You know, that were on board. You know, there's still, you know, kids that I'm in touch with from, you know, the first year that I was a teacher, you know, who, like, if you asked them, they would say, yeah, you know, Mr. Hammond's class, you know, changed my life, right? But it was like five. Right. And I'm not trying to downplay that, like, it's not important. But, you know, if you take that five compared to the 100, you know, the weight of it, for the vast majority of the kids that I was working with was just, you know, putting in their time. and so, you know, like I wanted, and also, you know, there's certain kind of like restrictions, but, you know, there's certain narrow kind of concepts that, you know, like, we're here to talk about, you know, X. And, you know, when we're like, you know, in Princeton Learning Cooperative or whatever, you know, there's I think better opportunities to really impact kids' lives in a bigger way, and not just sort of an academic kind of way as well. And I guess I was always sort of drawn, you know, to that aspect of it as well. You know, so if a kid doesn't want to talk about U.S. history, great. I don't need to talk to him about U.S. history. I don't need to force him to do that. We can talk about these other things that, you know, that might be more important to his life and their trajectory or whatever it is. So, you know, there's a certain flexibility that comes with, you know, sort of stepping out of the traditional system and still working with kids in the way that we do, which, you know, which I'm drawn to. I mean, and again, it's somewhat personal. Like there's lots of teachers. I don't want to, you know, my wife is still a teacher in the traditional system, and I have, a lot of my friends are teachers. You know, there are a lot of teachers who find real meaning and value in the work that they do, and it's not to downplay that. It's just for me, you know, I guess I was just looking for something different.
And did you find that you were able to build significant or meaningful relationships with your students outside of the classroom? I think that's another thing, an attractive idea that draws people into teaching. Maybe, you know, it's Dead Poets Society again, where they connect outside of the classroom environment. Was that a reality for you?
Once I left traditional teaching or when I was in school?
Oh, yeah. When you were still in school as a regular teacher.
There were certain, you know, kids that you would form like really serious, you know, deep relationships with. But just the structure of it was made that somewhat challenging, right? So, you know, I got 8 periods, you know, 45 minutes with the kids, 100 some kids. You know, there's a little bit of a sort of a conveyor belt kind of like marching through, you know, kind of thing. And so, you know, and then the time that you're not up there talking about U.S. history, you know, there's not a huge amount of sort of that just, I don't know, downtime. I don't know what you want to call it, but just time where you can make connections with kids. And so if you're not connecting with a kid through the course material, you know, there's not much else to do there, right? Some teachers, you know, do, but I think it's just much more difficult. Whereas, you know, Princeton Learning Cooperative, you know, the relationships that I have with kids, I mean, I do lead some classes, but that's a very, very small part of how I spend my time and my attention and focus. You know, the real, you know, crux of what we do, the real, I think, valuable thing is, you know, sort of the mentoring and, you know, the sort of the relationships that we form with our members. And it doesn't have to be just about, you know, U.S. history. It can be about, you know, everything or, you know, whatever, you know, their sort of experience or their sort of hopes and dreams, and you can connect with them on a much, you know, it seems to me, deeper level. Which is just really attractive to me as someone who's, you know, interested in working with young people.
So what was your favorite thing about being a teacher, both in public and private school? Like, when was it the best that it could get?
Oh, well, sure. I mean, you know, in my younger days, I was probably a lot more idealistic and, you know, so we would just do fun things. You know, there was a certain, you know, rebelliousness that I enjoyed, right? So like, yeah, we're gonna throw out the textbooks. Like, of course, those things are dumb, right? We're gonna like do this new and exciting way to do school. You know, and that was, I kind of feel like I took that just about as far as the limits inside the system could go, right? You know, zero curriculum. We're just gonna do things that are interesting, and we're gonna, you know, like, you know, really try to make it tailored to young people's lives and what they're interested in. And again, like I said, you know, that worked for some, but just over time, I just, you know, I guess I ran into maybe the limits of that, or at least the perceived limits that I had. And so that's when it, you know, like we would have, you know, it was back in the day, when like, there's a lot of, sort of political activity around, like, you know, sweatshop labor, if you remember, like, you know, college movements to like get their, you know, apparel, you know, college sports apparel team, you know, companies, yeah, to not, yeah, you know, if you remember all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we do like a sweatshop fashion show, and like, you know, kids would come in with their clothes and they'd research, you know, the conditions under which, you know, these were made, and talk to the class a little bit about it. And we'd have like, you know, we did like a light show and had like a DJ in the back of the room, and then people would do the catwalk. I mean, there was like, you know, which was fun, but like, you know, I don't know. A lot of kids.
That was the exception to the rule, I imagine.
Yeah. And still, you know, people didn't necessarily care. It was just like, well, this is a social studies class. I guess I'll do this. How many points is this worth? You know, it's just, you know, I don't know.
Someone who is starting a Liberated Learners Center on the West Coast recently wrote this about his decision to quit teaching in the Willamette Valley in Oregon. He said that my official position was a teacher of social studies, similar to you, Joel, grades 7 to 12, But teaching is a small fraction of what I actually did. I mostly developed and supervised tasks that managed teens for 45 minutes. I attended meetings. I filled out paperwork. I dealt with discipline issues. And I had to deal with this professional development as a teacher. And then he makes this comment that professional development for him turned out to be essentially the same experience that many kids have in school, which I imagine meant it felt pointless and inane. Does this ring true for you? Like, being a teacher, how much teaching did you actually do in comparison to all this management of students and bureaucratic tasks?
Yeah, I mean, I feel pretty fortunate, you know, especially at the first school I was at, you know, where there's no curriculum, there wasn't really a lot of oversight. I kind of wrapped up my teaching career right as sort of the real heavy parts of like the No Child Left Behind and I sort of got out. I watch what my wife has to go through in terms of the paperwork she needs to fill out, and it's brutal, right? I mean, it's just like, oh my God, there's no way. I'm glad I started, helped start the Learning Cooperatives when I did, because I would have had to just left and quit and did something else. Like, I couldn't have. It was bad. It is bad. I feel bad for teachers who are still in the classrooms having to deal with that. So I didn't feel that as much. I mean, there was a lot of management, yeah, and grading, whatever. The thing I think, that struck home from that statement, that I definitely felt strongly about, was the professional development and just how pointless it is. And it's exactly what kids feel, I would imagine, when they're in school. I don't think adults could almost put up with one day of what young people are required to do in high school, right? Like, sit there for 7 hours listening to people, and just think of your worst professional development conference you've ever gone to. You're sitting in the conference room at the Holiday Inn, just listen to somebody drone on like 7 hours.
But you can't leave.
You can't leave.
And you can't even lose yourself in your smartphone, right?
Yeah,
because somebody will yell at you.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I couldn't do it. I can't do it, right? And so, I don't know if this. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but like, when we were starting PLC, I was still teaching full time, and every professional development day for like 2 years, I just took off sick and worked on PLC things. There's no way I couldn't stomach it. I couldn't sit through it anymore. And that, to be honest, I mean, that was one of the real advantages, I think, of, doing, the Learning Cooperatives as compared to teaching. I thought that my, kind of the skill development that I had as a teacher was pretty limited and narrow. When we started the Learning Cooperatives, I had zero knowledge or understanding of, running a small nonprofit organization and all the things that requires in terms of, marketing and, sort of business administration. And, there's just a ton, there's a million things, bookkeeping. I mean, there's all this stuff that you have to do to successfully run one of these centers. And we just kind of, basically have had an intensive, learning experience, self-directed learning experience for the past, 8 or 9 years here. And it's, completely transformed as a person, from doing this work. I've taught for 11 years, and I couldn't have told you that I felt very much, very different at the end of those 11 years, right? I'm still kind of the same person. So, just from a personal growth standpoint, it's been a huge thing for me.
So we need to start talking about the Learning Cooperatives and North Star. And for those who are not familiar, can you give us the quickest of quick rundowns about what North Star and what the Learning Cooperatives and what Liberated Learners are?
Okay, so it's kind of two different things. So, Learning Cooperatives and North Star is just the idea of supporting young people and families to use self-directed education, right? So you can leave school, really take on the responsibility for your own learning, and then you have these centers and these communities to support you in doing that. Right. So, there's sort of mentoring that happens. There's a physical space that you can come and be with other people. There's classes, there's tutoring that goes on. There's help with college admissions. There's, all that kind of stuff. And, the real critical part of, Learning Cooperatives and North Star is it's just that everything that is offered is voluntary. There's no coercive you know, part of that system. You know, the attendance is optional. You know, all the classes and tutoring that's offered is optional. It's really just making opportunities and resources available to kids and then helping them, you know, navigate not only the resources and opportunities at the center, but also out in the community. That wasn't short, but that's kind of the gist of it.
Was it? That was shorter than I was expecting. Well done. Oh, thanks.
Okay, there you go. And then so Liberated Learners is sort of like the adult, kind of the adult version of that for teachers or other interested adults who want to work with kids, but not in in the traditional way. And, you know, like I said, if you go out and talk to, you know, 100 teachers, there's some huge percentage of them that would not be particularly thrilled with the way the education is headed. And so we get, you know, Ken did originally when North Star was the only sort of center using this model around, he would get all sorts of emails and calls from educators who found them and were like, oh my God, I want to do that. Like, help me do this. I was one of those people. You know, I sent an email after I found out about North Star back in 2007, like, oh my God, Ken, I need to do this. How do you do this? And so he was just, you know, kindly helping people out here and there as part of his work with North Star. And then after we started the Princeton Learning Cooperative, after a couple of years, you know, we keep getting these calls, and it was kind of like, you know, Ken, we should really have an organization that is set up specifically to help, you know, adults create places like this in their communities. Because the vision is just that, this way of learning, might not be for everybody. Like I say in the book, you know, I wouldn't have necessarily chosen this, when I was in high school. But it should absolutely be an option, for kids to have this kind of support, you know, in every community in the country. Right. So there needs to be thousands of these kinds of places.
I completely agree that yeah. Every small to medium sized city needs something like this.
Oh yeah. And so that's the vision of Liberated Learners, like, you know, help people start these things. Cause, you know, like I say in the TED talk, like, just close your eyes and put your finger on the map. You know, anywhere you land, there's going to be teachers in the high school.
They need this. Yeah.
Yeah. Who don't like it.
There will be teachers. There'll be potential people to found these and staff these centers.
Yeah. So Liberated Learners is supporting adults, you know, consulting with adults to open these things and run them successfully, which is challenging to say the least. And so it's, you know, that's sort of the mission of Liberated Learners. And then there's a sort of a network of centers that we've helped open that, you know, provide mutual support. And we, you know, do certain things together and, you know, so on and so forth.
And how many Liberated Learners centers are there now? And what's the trajectory looking like?
Well, let's see. I think there's maybe 13 at the moment. And then we're working with a couple of sort of new groups who are interested in founding one that they haven't started yet. Actually, Ken's in the Philippines at the moment, working with one of the groups, his first sort of off of North America group that we've worked seriously with. We've kind of added a couple each year. Over the time that we've been around. I mean,
awesome.
The idea is, you know, Ken and I talk about, you know, like, this is sort of like the next phase in the type of work we want to do. So, you know, if you're going to get to a couple of thousands of these places, you know, hopefully the pace will accelerate.
more than a few a year. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or start extending your lifespan. Mm-hmm. Great. So people who want to learn more about Liberated Learners, which is the network for helping people start centers like these, can go to liberatedlearners.net.
Correct.
And you are the co-founder of Princeton Learning Cooperative and Bucks in Raritan, all within the New Jersey, Pennsylvania area.
Yep.
You sound busy. Don't you have a family?
I do have a family. I don't know. I mean, I still do other things. I don't
know. You have hobbies, I hope.
I run. I'm doing a Spartan race on Sunday, like an obstacle course race with some of the PLC kids. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Let's circle back to what makes a teacher like even head down this path. And then let's talk about how hard it is to start a learning center. Mm-hmm. So what is it when a teacher starts questioning their path? Of course, somebody might quit and they might go in a totally different direction. They might go become an investment banker. They might go do who knows, you know, dog training. But have you noticed in your conversations any more common paths that teachers who are frustrated with the system end up taking? What are your options if you're a teacher who likes teaching but doesn't like the system?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that's what I was confronted with. You know, when I was really got to the worst part, you know, worst time when I was teaching. You know, I don't know. I mean, I did like working with kids. It was just in that way. I didn't know what the other options were. I mean, thank God I came across North Star. You know, it's some huge percentage. I don't, maybe you've looked at this up more recently, but you know, like number of new teachers that leave the profession within the first 5 years, it's some huge percentage, right? Like 50. I forget what it is.
I'm not sure, but yes.
Yeah, it's some, you know, look it up. I mean, it's some really, really big number. You know, I don't know what a lot of those people do. I would imagine they go into other professions. You know, you can hear, you know, I've heard of people, you know, like starting tutoring businesses or, you know, other areas where you're working with kids, but just not in the traditional school. I mean, you know, from my standpoint, I mean, I think you know, I was interested in working with kids in a mutually consensual way, right? Like they wanted what I had and I wanted to work with them, right? That's pretty rare, you know, to find mm-hmm. situations where that is the dominant sort of relationship with the kids. You know, maybe summer camps, you know, maybe but some like...
Even yeah. In summer camps, parents will sign their kids up and just ship them off.
Right.
A shocking amount of the time.
Yeah. Particular summer camps, I guess. Right?
Sure, right.
You know, like that kind of stuff. You know, maybe like teaching karate lessons. I don't. You know, there's some of these things where you know people sign up voluntarily and you know have some you know sort of independence. But it's not a lot. I mean, as a lot of people have pointed out, young people's lives are pretty well, I don't know, directed for them. And so, yeah, I don't, you know, that's why I started one of these, because it's like I wanted to work with kids, but in this other way, and I didn't see a lot of other people doing it that way. Mm-hmm.
Did you have anyone who told you that you were quitting too soon, that you were giving up and you just needed to stick it out a bit longer? Or did you tell yourself that?
No, that thought never crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. 11 years felt like I'd given it a real try. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of people tell me I shouldn't quit because you're crazy. You're giving up, you know, what essentially is like around, at least in this area, it's almost like you hit the lottery in terms of teaching. You know, the public schools around here, the district I was in, if I was still there, you know, I'd be making over $100,000 a year with full benefits, almost free, and you know, no chance of being fired unless I committed some sort of like major crime, you know. And so, you know, to walk away from that, a lot of people were kind of like, wow, that's kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. But, you worked your whole life to get here, and now for some idealistic reason, you're walking away from it.
You know, and I had sort of lucked into that position. You know, we just knew some people who were part of that school district, and you know, when they were hiring for social studies teacher, you know, like the school district I was in, you know, for every open position they get, you know, 100 applicants or something. And so it was, you know, there's people who have been looking for a full-time job and just subbing for a decade, you know, in this area, because it's, you know, people want to get into these districts so bad. So walking away from that, I think was shocking to a lot of people. Like they didn't understand why.
Now, if you were given advice to yourself as a teacher who had just spent a few years in the system, two mm-hmm. or 3 years perhaps, would you have told yourself to wait a little bit longer to see if it gets better, to see if you know a new classroom brings a new atmosphere? And do you think that's reasonable advice? I'm getting towards the question here, Joel. Mm-hmm. When is it too soon for a teacher to quit teaching if they're really not enjoying it?
Yeah, that probably would just be different for every person. I mean, you know, obviously, like my dad, I think put in 42 years or something before he retired, right? I mean, he was pretty tired at the end of that, but you know, like for other people, you can find out real quick that it's just not for you. I mean, the thing that I would say to people, sure, with any other, like any job, I mean, there's some sort of learning curve, right? You know, the first year you're a teacher, it's usually a disaster. But by year like 3, 4, you know, if you haven't kind of got the swing of it, or if it's not sitting right with you, it might not. And, you know, so the decision making that went through my head when I was thinking about, you know, leaving and doing something else, was, you know, just looking at, you know, 20, 30 years down the road, right? So, you know, if I'm at year 8 or 9 here and I hate it this much, I mean, it was having a seriously negative impact on the rest of my life as well. You know, I was all stressed out, and, you know, I hated waking up and going to where I went every day. Like I would imagine many young people, with school, right? And you think of, you know, think about the results of that and some of the challenges young people have who really don't like school. And I was like, you know, sure, there's money, sure, there's benefits, sure, there's, you know, a certain amount of security here. But it was just horrifying to me to look, you know, this is what my life's going to be like for the next 30 years. Mm. And so for me, you know, the trade-off between, you know, sort of the material benefits of continuing teaching versus, you know, I would rather have my time, and I would rather have my time be, you know, meaningful and, you know, so there's certainly stress that comes along with doing the work and the learning cooperatives, but it's like self-chosen, and it's for what I feel is like a meaningful purpose. And so, you know, it doesn't have the same, for whatever reason, it doesn't have the same effect on me as you know, teaching did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
It does make sense to me. What in the book you wrote about visiting some pretty like underprivileged schools and seeing the inequalities there, and you mm-hmm. felt extremely motivated to like help disadvantaged kids. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I know that for a lot of my friends who are interested in teaching or education, that the social justice function of becoming a teacher is a powerful force. Mm-hmm. And so where are you on that now? I imagine some people say like, oh, you started a learning cooperative and you have to charge us $12,000 and it's in Princeton, New Jersey. So you just gave up on any sort of social justice and you're just working with rich kids. And I'm just trying to make a caricature of this sure. argument here. And so, yeah, where does that sit with you now? Like the being of service to society and not just a thin sliver of society. I'll stop talking now.
Well, it's actually 13,000. It's a little bit more.
Let's not understate the value of a Princeton Learning Cooperative tuition.
Yeah,
yes.
Let's not understate it. I come from rural Ohio, up by Toledo, and so I didn't, it's just everybody, there wasn't extreme, you know, it's like a farming town. You know, lots of corn. So, I wasn't really exposed to really vast differences in wealth, and you know, everyone was just kind of at the same level. So when I went down to college in Miami, down by Cincinnati, I was, Miami got a lot of kids from like, you know, sort of the Cleveland, Columbus, Chicago suburbs. And so it was really the first time, you know, I came into contact with people whose families had like really significant, you know, financial means. And at the same time, the first year I was down there, we had to go visit a school as part of the teacher education program. And one of the places I visited was, kind of an urban school down in Cincinnati where like they couldn't afford paper. And so, you know, someone who hadn't really experienced that, you know, I was getting, you know, both sides of that inequality. And it really had an impact on me, just seeing the difference, and, you know, it was just all new to me. And so, you know, like, the social justice side of it, is still important. So, I mean, the thing to know about, you know, Princeton Learning Cooperative, and I think all of the centers in Liberty and Learners at this point, is, you know, we don't turn people away for financial reasons. You know, so we I think out of our budget, you know, maybe like a third, more than a third of it goes towards fee reductions. You know, we have people, families who can afford the full amount, and, you know, that's great. We have people who are, you know, giving us $50 a month. It's just depending, you know, whatever, if we have the ability to take people on, we do. It's not, exclusively, and also Princeton, I mean, the name obviously has a lot of cachet with the university, but, there's definitely, it's not all rich people that live in Princeton and in the area around there. And we draw from, probably a 20-mile radius around Princeton as well. So we work with all kinds of kids and all kinds of financial backgrounds as well.
Okay. And this is something that I've always loved, and I try to speak about whenever possible, the fact that North Star and the Liberated Learners Centers pretty much accept every motivated applicant who, will work with you on creating a payment plan. And I think that's one of the coolest things about the Liberated Learners Centers in comparison to similar alternative schools or democratic free schools where perhaps there's not so much leniency in paying the tuition. So congratulations, and please keep it up.
Yeah, thanks. It comes back to somewhat of the kind of the business model, if you want to call it that, or the structure of the thing, it's not a school. And that's one of the, I think, advantages of doing this kind of thing. You don't have to buy some huge building. You're not putting out thousands and thousands of dollars for like textbooks or supplies, whatever. It's a very low overhead model. The big thing is just, obviously staffing and, rent and insurance. So, if you can cover that, it's not too bad, actually.
Grace Llewellyn wrote the Teenage Liberation Handbook. You mm-hmm. read that when you were in college. Mm-hmm. You have written the Teacher Liberation Handbook. Is there any coincidence, any overlap between those two titles?
Well, I wrote to Grace before I titled it that and made sure she was okay with that. that was one of the conceptions. It was what the Teenage Liberation Handbook did for sort of just self-directed education for young people. The idea was to write a book that would do the same thing for adults and teachers. Who wanted to be involved in working with kids in that way.
And was Grace's book as influential on you as it was on Ken? And by the way, our very first interview on this podcast was with Ken Danford about North Star, and he mm-hmm. talks about Grace in the Teenage Liberation Handbook there. But where did Grace's book play a role in your decision-making process? Did it come back in when you were a teacher? Did you revisit it?
I did. I wrote a blog post about this. The metaphor I used was like space people talk about, like if there's an asteroid or some massive object coming towards the Earth, the idea is you don't like blow it up. You just like, all you got to do is like send a probe out there and just like nudge it a little bit when it's like 100 million miles away or however far it out is. You just got to like move it an inch, and by the time it gets to the Earth, like it's completely not a problem. That was like, for me, Grace's book felt like that little nudge that just set my life on this completely different trajectory. So when I was a miserable teacher in probably 2006, 2007, I had that book from shortly after I got out of college, and I just was reading it one night. And like I said in the book, there's like a I don't know, four sentence description of North Star in there. And I think it was called Pathfinder. North Star used to be called Pathfinders, listed as Pathfinder in the book. And I remember just going, huh, that's kind of interesting. Maybe I should like look that up. And, I found that they had changed the name to North Star and found them. And it really, changed. So, I mean, I give all sorts of credit to Grace's book. I wouldn't have found North Star otherwise, and we wouldn't have done all this stuff. My life would be completely different. Now I'm fortunate enough to sort of know Grace in person, and now she's starting a Liberated Learners Center. And
it's full circle. It's full, beautiful.
It's huge. Yeah.
That's right. That teacher who I quoted earlier is Matt, who is one of Grace's first hires. at the Hive in Eugene, Oregon. And I got to go hang out with Grace and run a workshop for her to sort of help build up the audience for the Hive earlier this year. It was great.
Awesome.
Yes, she's wonderful. Everyone, go read the Teenage Liberation Handbook. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the decision to quit in terms of financial realities.
Sure.
You were saying that you got a pretty premium position as far as public school teachers go.
Yeah.
And what enabled you to walk away from that financially, considering that, did you have a kid at that point when you quit teaching?
My daughter would have been very, very young when we started PLC, mm-hmm. like one and a half, something like that.
So new father, mm-hmm. paying a mortgage on a house, I believe.
Yep. Yes.
And you're walking away from this position. And so you have your ideals and you also have financial realities. And so what enabled you to do that? And what enables other people who start similar centers to do that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so there's some sense that, you know, it's specific, but, you know, in some ways it's general, right? So like, you know, talk to anyone who started an organization or business or whatever, you know, you got to have some resources to do it. Right. For the most part. And so, you know, we didn't, when we were starting the Learning Cooperatives, we didn't have like a huge pot of money. But what the founders did have, the resources we did have, was the ability to work for a while, with, for little or no pay as, you know, we grew the organization. It's like any sort of like, you know, bootstrapped tech startup or something like that. Right. Where, you know, you're the essential capital for starting the thing is just lack of payment at the beginning. So, you know, what allowed us to do that, you know, is like, you know, my wife and I, you know, fortunately didn't have massive amounts of debt. You know, we hadn't like racked up credit card debt. We had a little bit of money saved up. You know, she had, you know, she was still a teacher in that same public school system, so was doing all right. There were benefits paid for. So, you know, there wasn't really a time when I was, you know, quitting my job where I thought that I was really putting my family into jeopardy, right? And, you know, and quitting the job, I mean, it sounds like this big, huge, momentous thing, but, like, not really. Like, plan B, you know, like, if PLC folds after a year and a half, you know, I start subbing in schools, get another teaching job, whatever. You know, it might be a little dent in the long-term trajectory, but, you know, it wasn't life-ending. And so, you know, we had the ability to do that, fortunately. And then, you know, as we build it up, you know, we were able to do that. So, you know, that's certainly one model. And I would say, you know, the vast majority of the Liberated Learners centers, you know, because we're not, you know, people in the network are not independently wealthy. We don't have huge benefactors. And so a lot of people have done it sort of that kind of bootstrap startup sort of thing. And they've just been, for whatever reason, they've been able to, you know, work that with their personal resources. You know, it would be lovely. You know, I don't recommend starting it that way necessarily. Like if you know somebody who's got $250,000, who's willing to kick that in to support you for a couple of years while you build the thing, you know, great. You know, we just didn't want to, like, you know, we didn't think banks were going to give us that loan. We didn't want to go into debt to do it. You know, so that's just the way we chose to do it. But, you know, you could certainly try to get funders to fund these startups. And that's certain, you know, certainly something that Liberated Learners is looking into, is like, you know, maybe there's some larger donors and things like that would be interested in supporting a network, not just an individual center, but, you know, network of centers. Maybe that's more attractive to large donors. So
all those wealthy philanthropists out there listening to this episode, you know who to contact, joelhammond.com.
There you go.
Do you know of anyone within your network or anyone who has started an alternative school who has not had to take a serious pay cut in the process? Anyone who has managed to, like, make an equal salary to whatever the public school district would be paying? And maybe that's unfair. Maybe I should be saying to what a local private school, an independent private school, would be paying.
Yeah. We mean like year one, like day one?
I don't know. What's a fair comparison then? You know, 3 years after starting it up, perhaps?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, sure. You know, like we, you know, I, And just to back up for one second, I think, you know, in terms of the alternative education, you know, model and, you know, different centers and schools and things like that, that's one of the things I've been really focused on. It's just that, you know, I don't think those places have a hard time, right? It's hard to run one of those and make it financially sustainable. And that's really the place where a lot of those, you know, where it falls down, right? It's not from an educational standpoint, like those, it works, right? It's usually from the business side of it. It's usually from the money side of it. And so we wanted to, you know, what we're really trying to do here is try to pioneer and figure out a model that can be, you know, financially sustainable for the people who are involved and so on. So like Princeton Learning Cooperative and the other learning cooperatives, you know, I mean, that's where we're working on. So like within, I don't know, like 3 or 4 years of PLC, you know, we were making salaries that was, you know, comparable to, I'd say, you know, like you said, the private schools in the area. And, you know, we feel pretty good about that. And, you know, it's not, like I said, it's not what I'd be making in public school, but I gladly take it. And, you know, have a better experience in my life just in terms of how I spend my time. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Why are all the liberated learner centers on the East Coast, Joel? Like, why are they in the Northeast? Is this some sort of history of, you know, utopian alternative schools in Massachusetts? Why are there almost none on the West Coast? Riddle me this.
I don't know. That's your job. You got to figure that out.
My job. You're the co-founder of Liberated Learners. I'm looking for an answer here.
Well, I've never been. Well, I guess I was in Utah one time.
Okay.
I don't make it to the West Coast very often. So yeah, I don't know. I think maybe it's just a time function, right? You play this out for 50 years, and there'll be so many on the West Coast that'll be, yeah, won't be an issue. I don't know why it started on the East Coast. I don't know, just proximity maybe. But there's, you know, Grace is starting one up. Hopefully there'll be some more.
Okay. 50 years. That's the answer. I'm sure they'll be there in 50 years.
It seems to me it'd be ripe, right? Like just.
Exactly. That's why I'm asking the question. It's like all these other startups happen out there and not just tech startups, but there are a lot of alternative schools that are a little bit more focused on like measurements and metrics and they are more tech influenced and there's a culture of that out there, but why there haven't been things like North Star, I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I really don't know. I'm trying to plant little ideas, little seeds among the movers and shakers in California.
We'll just start making introductions for us. Well, we're happy to talk to people.
Okay. I've already started, but work harder. You mentioned earlier that starting Princeton Learning Cooperative was this whole education sort of in entrepreneurship and there's a lot that you had to figure out along the way.
Yeah. So
for someone who is currently teaching but is thinking about jumping ship and starting some sort of small private alternative school, do you have any advice in terms of like what skills you can start building now? What kind of work you can put in now before you get to the really critical phase? You can be more prepared to do this kind of thing. What do you wish that you knew before you started PLC?
Well, almost everything. I mean, there's some sense it's like you can do all the learning you want to, all the academic and sort of like theoretical learning you want to, but you don't really ever know until you actually get in there and do it. Right. So, you know, there's things that I've learned that I found really important, for successfully running, you know, say PLC, that if you would have told me those things when I was first coming out of teaching, I've been like, yeah, but I probably wouldn't have seen the importance of it because I didn't really know the relevance. Right. The things that I've found most useful, I'm trying to think back to myself, 10 years ago. I think what was useful for me is because I had zero exposure to anything about running an organization, right? I never looked at a budget. I didn't know what a budget was. had no idea, you know, like I'd sort of heard of like nonprofits, but it had nothing, knew nothing about how to run one or like what the legalities of it were. You know, knew nothing about, you know, marketing or outreach or, you know, anything. And so, you know, what some of the things that I did in preparation for that is, you know, I started volunteering on a local nonprofit. It was actually like an organic farm with like some educational programs attached to it. And, you know, so I started volunteering there, and then they eventually asked me to be on the board. So, you know, I did that for a couple of years before we started PLC. So, you know, I got to see how organizations functioned. I saw, you know, how budgets are created, how challenging it is to get everyone on the same page to do something. You know, I started looking at, you know, evaluating programs on a financial basis, whether this works or not, you know, strategic planning, all this stuff. But I had, it wasn't like theoretical. It wasn't like I read the book on how to manage a nonprofit and that would, you know, it was learning that stuff in relationship to a real situation that I was involved in. And so I think there's some of that stuff that you could do. I mean, you know, you could certainly be working full time as a teacher and just start getting involved in organizations and learning from people who do it. You know, that's just the way I learn best, I guess.
No, that's super helpful advice.
Yeah.
I also have almost no knowledge about how nonprofits and other organizations with boards work. And
yeah.
Yeah, just getting involved with one or being part of some sort of board, even if it's a small organic farm or some other small organization.
Yeah,
that's great advice.
And you might find just like things not to do, right? It might not be like the best example of
do
it this way.
You can dysfunction and say, let's just not do that ever.
Yeah, just like cautionary tales.
The staff at Princeton Learning Cooperative, are a lot of them other former school teachers?
At one point, you know, six of us were like, you know, like full-time, long-term teachers who left. And then Allison, who's on the board of Liberating Learners as well, she was trained as a teacher, but then ended up doing educational statistics for ETS, Educational Testing Service in Princeton, before homeschooling her boys. And then she joined the staff pretty much as her kids were sort of finishing high school as homeschoolers. So we were able to snag her. And thank God, because we didn't know anything about what we were doing. So she brought a lot of experience, just like, how do you learn if you're not in school? Sort of the resources and, you know, approaches and stuff like that. So that was really great.
So what is it that former teachers sometimes struggle with when they are getting into this different mindset, this learning cooperative mindset, consent-based education, kids don't have to show up to your classes? what are the common struggles for people who, you know, who want to be teachers? They don't want to teach in the regular system, so they find something like your organization, and then what?
Yeah, it's I actually, you know, you know, people talk about like sort of de-schooling or whatever in the unschooling movement. I kind of felt like I had to go through that as a teacher. You know, working with young people, I remember very distinctly one of the first year I was on staff at PLC. You know, sitting there one day, everyone, you know, like kids are like on their computers playing games. Nothing's really happening, you know, like from an education, you know, like from a school perspective. You know, there was no learning, quote unquote, learning going on. And just going, what have I gotten myself into? Is this really helpful to young people? Aren't I supposed to be like imparting knowledge in some way? You know, like I think there's, and I grew up, you know, in the traditional model. And so there was a lot of sort of basic assumptions that I came with what, you know, learning was supposed to look like, that, you know, I had to sort of dispense with. And just like simple things like this, you know, like if you go into the common room at PLC on any given day, there's a bunch of people sitting around chatting, playing ping pong on their computers, doing whatever. And, you know, from a school teacher perspective, you know, you look at that and go, what a waste of time. These kids are, you know, not learning anything. But like from a sort of life perspective and just sort of a learning perspective in that way, like, you know, I got to tell you, I think that like learning how to make friends and have decent relationships with people is probably a more important skill down the road than like, you know, quadratic formulas. I don't know. You know, and not downplaying the importance of math in some paths. But like, I don't, you know, at this point, you know, I don't really prioritize, you know, abstract academic knowledge over, you know, kid learning how to play guitar, or a kid, you know, who for the first time in their life is making friends, or, you know, whatever, you're having positive relationships with their peers around them. You know, all of that stuff is, you know, to me just as important as, you know, coming in and listening to me ramble on about, you know, Civil War or something, you know, I don't know.
Do you do that? Do you ramble on about the Civil War and other historical topics?
All the time. Well, not all the time. For 1 hour a week.
Like, okay. What's the class called?
U.S. History.
Oh, and innovative.
It's not. That's the point. Like, it's totally non-innovative, right? Like, and that's the other thing that I sort of got away from, is, you know, like when you're a teacher, and I think it's because you have to like put on a circus show. There's all these kids who don't want to be there, and you got to like, yep, da, 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 da. You got to like get their attention somehow, right? And so you got to have all these like super innovative things and these like simulations and games and, you know, this, that, and the other. And, you know, like when the kids don't have to be there, they're actually, the only reason that they're in my U.S. history class is because they've voluntarily walked in there, right? It doesn't particularly matter the method for the most part, right? I just kind of go in there and I kind of ramble on about stuff. We have discussions and whatever. And I'm like, are you guys sure this is interesting to you? Because it seems really boring to me. And they're like, no, this is great. But you know, if it didn't work for them, they don't have to stay there. They're not a captive audience. You know, if they would rather learn about U.S. history from, you know, going and volunteering at the Princeton Battlefield, you know, Historical Society, go do that. You know, you want to, you know, read a stack of, you know, books that you picked out on your own about the U.S. Civil War, and you don't want to listen to me talk about it. Great. You know, so I don't have to have ownership of that, right? Like, I'll help you. Yeah, you'd rather like read a stack of books. I'll help you find books if you want my help to read. But I'm just not going to be, you know, forcing you to do that.
So, how many kids show up to your U.S. history class once a week on average, and what are their ages?
That's one of the bigger classes that happens at PLC. So, you know, we might have, you know, anywhere between around 30 kids usually at PLC. And so, you know, like 12 of them would show up.
Like 40% of the student body.
I know. And sometimes I also teach a current events class. Sometimes it's even more than that. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's a good chunk. And what was the other part of that question?
How old are they?
Oh, yeah. So it's, you know, we work with kids. You know, 12 is about the youngest, up to like 18 or 19. And it would be that whole range. You would have 12 year olds in there. We have 18 year olds. Another thing I'll say is, you know, I think a lot of people think Liberty Learners works just with teenagers. That's not the case. It's just most of the centers who've started just happen to, you know, we do have centers that there's nothing philosophically that this only works with older kids. We have centers that work with kids all the way down to 5.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Are there ever moments when the students in your U.S. history class do not display the sort of etiquette or good graces that a more traditionally schooled student might have been trained to display? And does that ever get under your skin?
You mean like just like staring at their phone the whole hour?
Yeah, or just like getting up and walking out in the middle of you talking. Something that yourself as a teacher, you know, you can't help but feel annoyed by.
People getting up and leaving, and I don't care. I mean, there's some, and it's not like school etiquette, but you know, like one of the things we, you know, I'll talk to people about, especially because we have like a lot of volunteers that come in to work with kids. And it's more just like a personal etiquette sort of thing. Like if, like anything, like if you invite your friend to coffee and then you just stare at your phone the whole time, like, I don't know, it's not so great. You know, so, you know, we might just mention, you know, like, the whole class has their phones out. It's like, well, why? We don't need to be here to like look at your phones. Like you could go out there. But it's not like, you know, like this shaming, like you're doing something horrific. It's just like, I don't know, if you're going to voluntarily show up for class, maybe get something out of it. I don't know. Might want to put your phone away. So yeah, there's not too much, you know, I mean, if somebody's, again, I think it's the nice thing, it's not a captive audience. I think that's where a lot of the problems that teachers have to deal with in school come from. Like, you know, you don't want to be here and you're going to act out and do all this crazy stuff. Like, fine, like go for a hike. I don't care.
They just, probably won't show up to your class in the first place.
They probably won't show up in the first place. And if they do, I mean, you maybe it's like, hey, you know, guys, can you just hold on a second? You know, if they're like getting out of control and like negative impacting the rest of the people in the class, maybe they might not realize that. But yeah, I mean, just – like, yeah, you can't sit still. Fine. Like go outside, walk around for a little while, come back when you're ready. Like it's just not, people just have autonomy to take care of themselves and what their needs are, right? You need to go to the bathroom, go to the bathroom. You're hungry, have a snack.
Yeah. You know, like a snack. I was about to say, how many problems in school could be solved by like saying, go eat a snack.
Yeah. Go. Yeah. Take a nap. Like
take a nap and come back and then you can focus again.
All sorts of problems.
Yeah,
is the answer.
So these volunteers, are these? Do you have Princeton University students who are volunteers?
Yes, I mean this is really the only way that these Liberated Learner Centers can work. I mean, I'll speak specifically for PLC, but you know, let's say we have 30 kids. We'll have three full-time staff members, right? And then we have something like, I think this past year we had like 35 volunteers who come through on a weekly basis, right?
Wow.
And so some of the, you know, I think we do have a work study relationship with Princeton University. So so they can get, you know, work study money. We hire them as an off-campus employer. And then they, you know, a lot of times they'll do like tutoring with kids, like, you know, work one-on-one with kids in math or writing. Sometimes they lead classes. Like we had a girl this year who's grew up in her mom was deaf, and so she learned American Sign Language. So she led an American Sign Language class for a handful of kids at PLC. So you know, we'll get a handful of you know, Princeton University students each year. But then, you know, it's like 30 adults from the community just come in and either work with kids one-on-one or lead small classes, or, you know, it's really amazing. And a lot of people when they're starting these centers are like kind of unsure about that. Like, really, can we really ask people to like volunteer and like come in and work with kids? And, you know, our experience is like, you know, people love it, right? Like there's lots of volunteers that we talk to who are like, you know, coming in here for an hour a week and working with a handful of kids who are really interested in what I can offer is like the best hour of my week. You know, it's, they look forward to it. They love it. It's meaningful to them. To give back to young people in that way. And there's not, you know, a lot of opportunities for people to do that, really, to have, mm-hmm. you know, not access to young people, but, you know, just sort of, you know, be in a relationship with young people where they can share some of their knowledge and skills. And so it's really just, you know, it's a lovely arrangement, to be honest. And, you know, particularly in Princeton, there's a ton of really amazing people live in that area and who can give other time. But we found that also, you know, at our other centers, not in Princeton, you know, we have tons of, they just come out of the woodwork, right? You know, like we just kind of put it out in the universe, like, we have some kids who are interested in learning Japanese. And then like, you know, like a native born Japanese speaker shows up and comes in for an hour a week and does Japanese with the kids.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever have challenges with volunteers bringing in school-like kind of attitudes or methods of discipline and organization that you as an organizer have to gently, you know, coax them into letting go of?
We generally are pretty hands-off about that, right? You know, because, like, volunteers have to feel like their time is valuable, and you know they're getting out of it what they want to as well. What usually it's a pretty self-policing community, right? So if a volunteer comes in and really sucks, or just doesn't get it, and it's not useful for the kids, they just vote with their feet.
No one shows up to any mentorship meetings, to any classes. They're just ignored and shunned. That's a pretty clear message, I bet.
Yeah, and you know, and we try to, you know, because we really, really appreciate our volunteers. I mean, they're amazing, right? We couldn't run the program without them. And so, you know, if there's a volunteer that doesn't work out or the kids aren't particularly interested, and sometimes we have volunteers who, like, one year have, like, 10 kids that come to their class and they love it. But then it's just, like, the different mix of kids the next year, no one's particularly interested. So, you know, we always are, you know, we spend a lot of time developing relationships with our volunteers, and we have happy hours for them, and you know, we do all sorts of things to make them feel like they're really, which they are, they're really part of the sort of the staff of the center. But if it's really not working out, often the kids will, you know, let their mentor, their full-time, you know, the core staff members know, like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to go to this class. And if, like, a number of people are doing that, we'll find some really nice way to, you know, thank them for their time, and, you know, just, you know, we'll keep you on the list if anyone else comes up that might be interested.
It sounds like a really great part of your job at Princeton Learning Cooperative. You get to bring people from the community in to share their diversity of skills or interests, and I imagine they're cycling through on a regular basis. And so you're meeting new people. You are getting exposed as an adult to all these new subjects. If you get bored teaching your own class, you don't have to keep teaching it, you know, unless you're going to break the hearts of 12 right. teenagers.
Right.
But you can offer new classes based upon your changing and shifting interests and priorities. Also,
yeah.
It seems like it really contributes to your job satisfaction. Am I on base here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the only reason I lead any of the classes I do is because I want to and people are interested, right? It's not like I just get an assignment from the department chair that, you know, you have to teach this class, right? So it's really based on just our interests and whatever. And, you know, to the point of going out and reaching out to people, like we started a class last year. It's just called Career Explorations. And it's basically just, it's an excuse for us to write to people. So we just write to any, we have a handful of kids who are committed to like having lunch on one day a week. And we just write to any interesting people we find in the community and say, hey, would you be willing to come in for an hour and have lunch with a group of kids and just talk about your career and what you're interested in and how you got there? And we have like 100% success rate. Doesn't matter who we wrote to.
Wow. Awesome.
We just write to whoever. Like I read in one of the local newspapers, it was like this guy who's like a venture capitalist. He's like the fifth richest person in New Jersey. We just wrote to him. We're like, hey, would you be willing to come and talk to some kids about like biotech investing? He's like, sure. He just comes in, you know, for like four or five kids. And because, you know, I think maybe Grace says this in her book or something like that, like, the world is wide open to young people who are interested, you know, in like learning about stuff. Like, what person is going to like shoot down like a 15-year-old who writes to them and is interested in what they're doing? Very few.
They might be too busy, but yeah, I'm sure the interest and the flattery is definitely there.
Yeah. It's like a gold, you know, like the whole world is just like a gold mine waiting to be discovered, you know?
Is there any other way that you can think of that your current position really dramatically differs from your life as a public school or private school teacher, just in terms of your day-to-day mental health and happiness and maybe the, you know, the work you get to do? What has made the biggest difference? What's black and white?
I can probably count on my fingers and toes the number of days in the last 8 or 9 years where I got up really dreading what I was going to do that day. Right. It was like every day when I was teaching. And you know, I can't, you know, I cannot overstate, that difference. Right. And it's mirrored, by sometimes the situations that young people who come to PLC, you know, their daily existence every day is just terrible in school. And then all of a sudden, you know, they have this other way of doing things, and it's like a huge load just sort of being taken off their back, right? And it's sometimes a really dramatic effect for the young people, and it's been a really dramatic effect for me. So I don't know, you know, positive outlook on life. happy with how you spend your time.
Lack of cynicism and general anxiety, perhaps.
Yeah, like all of that. And you know, just, you know, having relationships with people that I want to, and I don't know. I don't think, other than, you know, maybe a little bit of money, I don't really think of anything that's, you know, not better.
So hold up, Joel. Are you telling me that if I am a disaffected teacher, that I can quit my job, I can start something kind of like a Liberated Learners Center, and within a few years, I'll have a decent chance of earning the same amount of money that I might earn not at a public school, but at a private school, and I can have much higher job satisfaction. I can have nice, respectful, consent-based relationships with the kids who I work with. I can teach stuff that I'm interested in, and the only kids who will show up to my classes are probably going to be really interested in what I'm teaching. And additionally, I can have all these relationships and mentoring opportunities outside of the classes, because classes are really not the main thing that happen at these centers. Are you telling me that I can have it all? Is that what you're saying?
I would say most of that. I mean, so that's the thing. I don't want to sugarcoat this, right? So I'm usually like, Ken, we do the good cop, bad cop routine when we're talking to new people. Ken's a really inspirational, like, you know, yes, you can do this and work with kids in this way, and it's, you know, whatever. I usually come in and I talk about the money part of it. So it's hard. It's incredibly hard to run one of these centers successfully financially, right? There's no other way to put it. There are Liberated Learner Centers that we've worked with that have opened and closed because they could not make it financially, right? There's zero sugarcoating that should go on about that, right? It's challenging. But, you know, if you can make it work, if you have, if you can build the team that can make these things run successfully, it's life-changing. And that's really, you know, what we're trying to do with Liberated Learners is like make it much more likely, you know, like don't make our mistakes. Like, you know, I've never advised people to start a center the way we started Princeton Learning Cooperative. It was ridiculous. In some ways I feel like we got lucky. But you know, we've had a number of years of experience now working with a lot of people, and that's like, you know, I think we've learned something about what it takes to run these things successfully, and sharing that with people so that they can like cut years off the learning curve is really what it's all about. Is that qualified enough of an answer?
I think you stripped the sugar off of my highly optimistic summary statement there. When is the next Liberated Learners, what's it called, a replication conference?
Well, that was what they used to be called.
I'm out of date.
Yeah, so we had, the way we do the conferences now is just for people who are running centers. So we actually just had that in June. So it's like, you know, members of Liberated Learners. What we've been doing with new folks who are interested in the model and maybe want to do this, we started to kind of have a different sort of path for that. So first thing is just, you know, talk to Ken on the phone. You know, ask questions, they'll tell you all about it. And then we have a series of webinars where Ken and I just get on like a Google Hangout or Google Meet or whatever they changed the name to. And just, you know, kind of, he goes over the philosophical parts of, you know, the centers, and I talk about the business side of it. We answer a bunch of questions, that kind of thing. And then we have, you know, if people are still interested and they want to, you know, get our help, you know, thinking through the planning stages of this, then we, you know, have consulting agreements with people. Actually, I just we have somebody in Ontario who's just going to be our next group that's starting. I'm going to be starting to work with them this summer. So there's kind of a we kind of broke it up. So there's you can take little steps along the way to find out if this is really what you want to do before you quit your job.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking on liberatedlearners.net and I'm looking at how much your fees are to take each of these steps, and they are incredibly reasonable. This is not some sort of package that you're trying to sell for some big amount of money, but most people won't actually implement it. Like it's obvious that you and Ken want to make this as accessible to possible and inform people progressively so that each time you go to this next level, you know that it's most likely the right step for you.
So that's the idea.
Yeah, yeah. This does not feel like you're trying to sell anyone some sort of package deal. That's wonderful. For people who are interested in this kind of stuff in general, the ex-teachers, the people like me who never even went into teaching because we drank the Kool-Aid too soon. There's Liberated Learners. There's also ALCs, Agile Learning Centers, and they do their own facilitator trainings. There are Sudbury schools, and there's a whole network of Sudbury schools, and I'm not exactly sure what the state of Sudbury school training is at this moment. Are there any other options out there that people should know about beyond the ones we just mentioned?
I mean, those are the big ones that I know of.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. Liberated Learners, ALCs, and Sudbury schools. They're all some iteration of something that looks like a democratic free school or a free school, or I know you guys don't call yourselves schools. You are learning centers. You are closed on Wednesdays just to prove that you are not a 5-day-a-week school.
There you go. Go make a life for yourself.
That's right. Don't come here on Wednesdays. Do your own thing.
That's right.
Great. Joel, thank you so much for being on the show. And there's a TEDx talk that people should watch. There's Liberated Learners. There's your book, which is available on Amazon, or I imagine other places too.
Actually just Amazon.
Never mind. Just Amazon. Total dedication. Yeah. Is there any way else that those who want more Joel Hammond in their life can get it?
It's probably a small group of people.
we're trying to expand the envelope here, Joel.
I'm generally responsive to email. So you can get in touch with me. I'll try to write back. Those are the big ways. And also before we break, Blake, I just want to say how appreciative I am of all the work that you've been doing over the years. It's really, really awesome. And a lot of, PLC kids have been at the camps, been on trips with you, and routinely come back and sing your praises. So thank you very much for the work you're putting out into the world.
Thank you, Joel.
Yeah.
All right. Warm fuzzies. We'll cut it there. Thanks, Joel.
Yep. Thank you.